Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of the magazine, and today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hi, Jordan. And our deputy editor, Matt Matum.
Hello.
So this week, we're going to be reviewing Charlize Theron's new Netflix action of The Old Guard, Ben Affleck's Finding the Way Back, Tom Hanks's Greyhound, and A Shaggy Dog Tale with Scoob. But first, boys, we should probably talk about Ennio Morricone, who died this week, and he had a huge output, was hugely prolific during his career. What was your favourite Morricone score?
Well, my third favourite film of all time is John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah.
So I would single out his work on that film in particular.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to the work he's best known for, obviously I'm thinking his numerous collaborations with Sergio Leone. What stands out about his work on The Thing for me is just how quote-unquote simple it is and just how kind of dreadfully affected it is when he uses just so few notes. And the interesting thing is that, you know, John Carpenter is no slouch when it comes to composing music for his films.
No, he does it himself, doesn't he?
Exactly, yeah. His themes for Halloween, Assault on Precinct 13, Escape from New York are rightly iconic, but I don't think even Carpenter could have done a better job than Morricone does with the theme for The Thing.
Very good. What about you, Matt?
Yeah, for me, probably The Mission would be very high up there.
That's mine!
Oh, sorry. And also, I know it's obviously a cliched set, but obviously the Dollars trilogy, just how kind of iconic and influential they are and how they just, when you hear it, they just immediately sort of transport you to watching the films. It just was just such a huge part of it. Yeah, even though it's an obvious call, I'd say those.
He's amazing at being able to produce scores that live sort of away from the film, that are beautiful soundtracks. The Mission you said there, I love that soundtrack. I will listen to that any day of the week. It's just beautiful. But then if you have watched the film, it adds that dimension and it is very good at sort of evoking a place. And obviously we can't not talk about it's so amazing. And again, it's what Jordan's saying, really simple, really not flowery musical makeup there, but you absolutely get a feel of a place and a sense of westerns and danger and all of the rest of it that goes with it. It's amazing.
Romanticism.
What he does with that. And obviously it's used now as a sort of a gag as well, that riff that everybody knows if you're doing a sort of intro to a cowboy thing. It's it's so iconic. And he was still sort of working right up to sort of last year, wasn't he? He was doing shows in London last year at the age of 90-odd.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. You know, he won his first and only Oscar for The Hateful Eight just a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I mean, one interesting side note about his music for The Hateful Eight, there were actually unused cues from his score for The Thing in that soundtrack. So even Morricone's like basic rejects, like his cutting room rejects, ended up winning an Oscar. Like that's how good he was.
Yeah. His sweepings off the floor are Oscar worthy. If only we could all say that about our work. So yeah, Morricone, we miss you. Thanks for all the great music. Shall we move on then and see what is being released this week?
Who are you?
You can call me Andy.
I lead a group of soldiers.
Fighters, like you.
With an extremely rare skill set.
What do you mean? Mother?
Let's just say we're very hard to kill.
So that is The Old Guard, which is an adaptation of a comic book. Jordan, who are The Old Guard?
Well, primarily Charlize Theron, but there are others as well. So this is Netflix's first big sort of attempt at, if not quite a superhero movie, certainly a super-powered sort of comic book blockbuster. Charlize stars as Andy. She's the leader of a team of immortal mercenaries known as The Old Guard. For millennia, they fought sort of from the shadows, righting humanity's wrongs. But when we catch up with the guard in present day, they've sort of lost their way a little bit. Andy and Booker, who's played by Matthias Schoenaert in particular, are just totally over immortality and very much going through the motions. But things change for the guard when they're hired by Chiwetel Ejiofor's Copley for a job that turns out to be a bit of a sting operation, which exposes their kind and their remarkable abilities, their immortality, to this nefarious sort of pharmaceutical company that wants to make a quick buck off their regenerative abilities. And then at the same time as this is going on, and for the first time in hundreds of years, a new member of the old guard is sort of activated. They aren't born immortal. There is a point in their lives when they realize that they have this ability to not die and recover from injuries. And the person who's activated is Kiki Lanes Nile. She survives sort of a fatal injury during a tour in Iraq. So the film becomes somewhat about Andy introducing Nile to life as an immortal warrior while on the run from these dangerous forces who want to capture them and, you know, dissect them like lab rats.
And that sounds pretty entertaining. And Charlize Theron is pretty good at all those things. But is she good in this?
I've got a feeling I know what Jordan's feelings are about this film, but I thought it was okay, basically nowhere near as sort of exciting as that premise makes it sound. But I thought it was perfectly fine as far as a generic sort of action film to watch at home. And it didn't live up to the promise of that sort of setup.
Maybe we should talk about what Jordan thinks of it, because he lowered my expectations quite a lot before I watched it.
I think
I was pleasantly surprised, actually. And I really quite enjoyed it for what it was, which is, it's not deep, it's not meaningful. You know, it has really nothing to say, but I just find watching Charlize kick ass and take names eminently watchable, and I loved watching her do her thing. You know, it's nice to see that she's the leader of the gang and the guys run round after her, and that the new recruit is another woman. I was a bit disappointed in Kiki Lane. I didn't think she really brought it. She's a bit insipid, but perhaps that's the script's fault. But Jordan, what did you think of it?
I'll point out up front that I didn't have a problem with Charlize at all. I think she's great in this film. She's always very watchable. And when she's kicking ass with like a giant axe, like, all the better. But the problem for me was the film just took itself far too seriously for a film with such a ridiculous sort of premise. Like, these people can get shot in the head and then they're standing 2 minutes later. There's so much like ineffectual musing about what it means to like live forever and what you do with your time on Earth. And I really just felt this needed an injection of levity, or, you know, just some fun somewhere, particularly in the action. I mean, these characters, as I said, they're immortal. They get shot and they just keep going. It does nothing that we haven't seen in like a dozen sort of John Wick clones. And it felt like there was a real opportunity to do something unique with the action choreography in particular. And they don't capitalize on any of those opportunities, except sort of in one moment, which I won't spoil, which is just a real shame, because you're not playing up to your USP at all.
There is something very flat about the film, I'll give you that. Apart from the presence of Charlize that obviously makes it feel very A-list and sort of upmarket and everything, there's something that feels a bit, I mean, I know it's sort of, it was always a Netflix production, not one of these films has been sold to Netflix, but it does feel a bit TV. There's something a bit kind of premium TV about it, like when you see flashbacks to the kind of, you know, these ancient warriors.
There's some wig issues on
some sort of cheap looking costumes, and where they clearly haven't got that many extras. And then the final showdown, you're kind of hoping that, you know, with all these immortal warriors, it's going to build up to just some kind of massive, you know, like action showdown. But it just feels like it's just in a fairly generic kind of building. And it didn't really crescendo like you kind of hope this kind of film might. But that said, I actually thought it was pretty watchable all throughout. And I like the team in general. Like, they do a couple of things nicely. Like, there's a gay romance in the team, and that's sort of handled pretty, just sort of subtly, and it's just there. And it's, I thought that was nicely done. They had some of the kind of better moments, I thought, in the film. And Chiwetel Ejiofor is someone, again, he's not really in it that much, but I actually thought he brought
something. He's bringing the class,
sort of,
isn't he?
And he brings like almost kind of borderline emotional at points, which again is the only time it even verged on that in this film for me. But I was actually like, fair play to me. He did a lot with a little.
And it obviously sets it up for another film. And, you know, there's no sort of qualms about that. They're like, this is your origin. And if we do you think it has the legs to go further? I mean, would you want to see another? And could they improve on it and make it more interesting for you, Jordan?
Well, the slightly annoying thing is it sets up a much more interesting sequel than the film we actually get here, which is incredibly frustrating when you have to sit through 2 hours of something you're not that interested in, besides one element where they're going, you've got to wait for the next one to see what happens here. So there's a lot of potential for the next one to be better, but it's annoying that we have to wait for it if that is the case. I don't know why you don't just go in with the first film all guns blazing. Maybe they felt they had a bit of a safety net with this being on Netflix and they're not dependent on, you know, weekend box office and all that kind of stuff. Like,
And let's face it, you know, like films like this on Netflix do extremely well. Six Underground did really well. Extraction did really well. And they're not particularly thought-provoking or clever films. But that's maybe what you want from Netflix. You just want something to have your curry on your knee. Or in the case of this, I think you probably need your baklava selection, don't you? Because Andy does enjoy her delicious desserts from Turkey and various other parts of the world. That seems to be her one sort of characteristic that they give her, that she enjoys a sweet meat. But it's dispensable, and maybe that's just what you want.
Yeah, but I guess for me, that was sort of the problem with it, because I thought it was aspiring to be something more than just dispensable. Like, it's not aspiring to be just pure throwaway fun. It wants to say something. The director, Gina Prince Bythewood, I actually spoke to her for the magazine, and she was telling me how everything that she worked on was sort of character focused, and it was all about these characters' journeys. And I just felt like that side was the bit that was really lacking for me. I thought that sounded like a great idea, like the idea of a really, you know, character focused comic book action movie could be great. It could be something very different from what we're used to seeing in the MCU and the DCEU. But this just fell really flat for me, because I don't think I was ever truly invested in the characters.
Yeah, I mean, if you compare it to something like Wonder Woman, Patty Jenkins, you know, crafting this amazing film that has all of those elements in it, it suffers by comparison, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I don't think this would have found an audience in a cinema, for example.
I think as well, because it is so po-faced, it does make it hard to take some of the sillier elements seriously. And there's a lot of kind of things that don't really make logical sense. Like, there's one element that I won't mention for fear of spoilers, but there was one thing that just, when you kind of think back, and I was like, that just doesn't make any sense how this character would have worked this thing out and how it fits into the sort of story we've been told. That's a slight problem when you do play it so straight-faced that, you know, you're kind of asking people to take it seriously, but it just doesn't hold up to particularly close.
You can't take seriously the baddie, can you? The pharmaceutical giant that is that kid off Harry Potter wearing a hoodie with a suit as some sort of characterization. And I don't know if he thought he was on a different film from the one everyone else was in. You do have to have a good baddie, and he didn't really stand up to that, I suppose.
It's a very odd performance choice. I mean, it's borderline pantomime. Like, I mean, fair play for going there, but it didn't really work for me.
Especially as like the heroes, you've got such charismatic actors like Charlize and just like Mateo Schoenaerts and people like that as well. And even Chiwetel kind of, you know, interacts with him quite a lot. In comparison to those kind of powerhouses, just doesn't really cut it.
It felt for me like he was going for a bit of like Alan Rickman in Robin Hood or Die Hard or something, but he just wildly overshoots and ends up, you know, somewhere on the moon instead of
and
on
I mean,
cinema screen.
Yeah, do not try to do the Sheriff of Nottingham a la Alan Rickman. No one can do that. That was a gamble that paid off for him, but it is the weak link, I agree. Okay, so are we recommending this for this weekend's viewing? Is it something you're going to enjoy with your takeaway?
I mean, I'd say stick to the comics, but you might have a different opinion to me.
If your expectations have been suitably lowered by Jordan, as ours were before we saw it, then I recommend
old
you.
Jordan.
I think you'll think it's fine, you know, it won't blow you away. You'll think, yeah, that was fine, that killed a couple of hours. If they do another one, please make it a lot better and, you know, like deliver on that potential more. But there's enough in there to enjoy over 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, if you thought you were going to get Charlize's Furiosa, which now we hear we're not getting her again, this is as good a sort of fix for you to get your Theron ass-kicking, you know, looking immensely cool in black jeans and just rocking a biker jacket scenario. So for me, I'd say have a go, but lower your expectations and obviously don't take that baddie seriously. Okay, so that's The Old Guard, which hits Netflix this Friday, the 10th of July. Okay, so from those who are tricky to kill to someone who seems to have a death wish, let's take a look at this. I was never sure how much
of you I could let in. I heard you're coaching basketball.
Yeah, keeps me busy, keeps my mind off other things, you know. Once you settle down, baby, here you love is been. I spent a lot of time hurting myself. Heavenly Father, I made a lot of bad decisions. Don't carry other names. I had a lot of regrets.
So that is Finding the Way Back, Ben Affleck's new drama about a man who is struggling with life and is brought in to coach a basketball team. What's going on with this character, Matt?
So yes, Ben Affleck stars in this. It's directed by Gavin O'Connor, perhaps most famously made Warrior a few years ago. This, I put it on a similar level of kind of like very much about male emotions and that sort of world. So Ben Affleck stars as a guy called Jack Cunningham. He's a sort of blue collar construction worker and he's an alcoholic. We see him like right from the off, he's sort of drinking beers in the shower in the morning and he's kind of filling his work flask with various different types of booze. We don't know a huge amount about him. We don't know exactly what he's been doing up to this point, but we learn that he was a kind of school basketball star. He was kind of, you know, like a star player back in the day, and things didn't work out for him in that sense. And his life seems to have gotten a bit of a slide, and we gradually learn a bit more about him as the film develops. And particularly he's brought in because this local Catholic school is in need of a basketball coach and they think that he's the guy to do it. And that's where the film kind of goes, really. So it's kind of half sports movie, half character
redemption
drama.
Movie. It's the sort of redemption of both of these things and the fortunes of both of these things, the basketball team and the man leading them. Did you like it?
I really enjoyed it. At first, I thought it might kind of suffer from having the cliches of both the sports movie and the redemptive drama kind of paired. But I actually just thought they just worked really well together. And obviously, there's this added dimension that you kind of can't really ignore, that with Ben Affleck having kind of been open in real life about his alcohol problems, that obviously adds an extra dimension when you're seeing this character. And I thought he was really good in it. I found it quite emotional in places. And obviously, it falls into some of the sports movie cliches, of course, you know. But regardless, I got sucked in by it. And I just thought it was a really, really sort of like nicely put together sort of mid-level drama.
Did you think it was a man movie, Jordan?
I don't know. I mean, I am a man, so maybe yeah. Because I also liked it, then it is a man movie. I'm interested to hear what your take is on it now. Yeah, I mean, I basically just agree with everything Matt says. I thought, you know, Ben Affleck's sort of commitment to the role I found really impressive. I found this sort of sports movie side of it, yeah, formulaic. It borrows, you know, liberally, especially from Coach Carter, because, you know, these kids are from quote unquote the wrong side of the tracks and they need kind of forming as a team. So you have that side of it going on as well. It's an odd marriage, but it does kind of work. There was a really good moment in this film where, despite, you know, the formulaic elements of it, I thought it did a really neat job of undercutting it, where it's a mild spoiler, but only a mild one, where you kind of get a victory moment complete with, like, you know, swelling music and this really cheesy, like, freeze frame smile. And then it kind of goes really dark and downhill from there. I thought that was a really neat moment that I really wasn't expecting.
It does sort of subvert your expectations of this sort of film, because the title alone is incredibly sort of generic. And when it starts off, it feels like it's just going down a sort of movie of the week kind of route of alcoholism is a terrible thing and this is how people are dealing with it. But, you know, as you say, it's impossible to separate Affleck's actual real life struggles with the sort of character he's playing. And I just think it's probably the best he's been since The Town. I really felt for him and had immediate empathy for him, even though he's obviously in such a bad way. He is drinking vodka on site whilst he's using very heavy machinery. I mean, this is not a good place to be in your life. But I sort of struggled with the basketball element of it, I have to say. And I think that's probably because I'm just not that into sports movies. I could have just done with how Jack was going to deal with sort of getting back. I didn't love the basketball side of it.
Yeah, but if you just do that, it's just Leaving Las Vegas, isn't it? Yeah. I think in the basketball, you're Leaving Las Vegas meets the Mighty Ducks, which just sounds like a much better film to me.
They should use that on the poster. Yeah.
Well, exactly. I like the way that the two situations sort of mirrored and reacted to each other as well. Like, I thought that they balanced the two quite well, actually. So that side of it did work for me.
Yeah, and also there's this sort of fact that it's a Catholic school and there's this element of Catholicism and repenting and all of that sort of thing and finding your way back, literally, to a place where you feel cleansed, I suppose, and that weighs heavy in it as well, because it's obviously his background and it's a Catholic school. So the head of that school is a priest and there's a chaplain of the team that's involved with everything as well. So that literally wrestling your demons was the side that really appealed to me.
Yeah, because I'm not a sports fan at all in real life, but I really do like sports movies. And yeah, I just thought this added an extra dimension that maybe it would have just been a bit sort of dry without it, perhaps. But it kind of gives it a bit of drive. But then also, as we kind of discussed, you know, without saying too much, it doesn't quite follow the path you sort of necessarily expect from a sports movie. And I liked that once that element comes in, it doesn't completely take over either. Like, it doesn't just become like, they don't just brush his problems aside and it's, this is just, you know, generic sports movie of the week now. But it still is an important part of the film, and it's still, you know, there's that tension, as Jordan was saying, sort of between the two sides of his life. And it gets a lot of nice little small things right, I think. Like, there feels like a lot of nicely observed details, and just stuff like early on you see him kind of just drinking can after can of beer, and he does this thing where he'll kind of take one out of the fridge and put it into the freezer and get the next one out, and just little kind of details like that.
Yeah,
just felt
the rituals
very true
of his life. Yeah. I thought the women in this were very good. His ex-wife, they have this very sort of painful lunch meeting where nothing is actually really said and everything is played out on their faces, the sort of devastation that he particularly feels in the breakdown of this relationship. And also, I thought his sister was really good. His reaction to her trying to care for him and his pushing away of her felt very true as well, and seemed to be something absolutely authentic. Do we think that this is something that could get Affleck awards traction? I mean, it's the sort of thing that traditionally they enjoy, and he has obviously won an award before at the Oscars, so they do like him. Do you think this is the sort of performance that could be his proper comeback and his anointing back into the fold?
I think if the release had been different, I think it could have been, but I think it came out in the US just before, you know, kind of COVID struck and, you know, all those problems kind of occurred at cinemas. And then obviously in the UK, it's getting this kind of premium video on demand release, where it was obviously originally scheduled for a cinema release in sort of springtime. So I wonder if it just might not quite get the attention perhaps it might have done, you know, if it had been released in the sort of traditional awards window. And then especially with the Academy sort of pushing back the deadline dates this year, there's going to be a rush of, you know, more traditional like Oscar friendly fare just nearer the time. So I reckon this probably won't stay long enough in people's memories, but I'd arguably say it's sort of deserved.
And it's sort of, it's nice to see Affleck doing good work again, because, you know, he's incredibly patchy. He does, you know, something really brilliant and writes something really brilliant and directs something really brilliant, and then will go and do something that you're just like, what is this? And you're terrible in it, you know. He's got a film coming out with his real life squeeze, Ana de Armas, next year, that's going to be like a sexual thriller. I just think he really does well with this sort of film, and I'd like to see him do more of this, I think, than any of those sort of sexy thrillers, which I worry might go down a Gigli route. Would you like to see him do more of this?
Yeah, it definitely feels like his comfort zone and where he's at his best. We should also point out that if this sounds like incredibly dark and challenging subject matter, this film's actually quite funny as well. Like, there's a really good recurring gag about swearing on the court, because there's basically rules against swearing in this Catholic high school. And Ben Affleck's character has a real potty mouth. And just every time he went off on one, I was chuckling to myself. It's not all heavy going.
No.
And the players are nicely etched as well. Like, kind of, given they don't have much screen time, you do kind of get to know a few little characters and things like that, you know, which I thought was well done in the sort of minimal screen time they get.
Good. So we are totally recommending this one from The Old Guard, which was this one is a yes, definitely buy this, do we say?
Yeah, it's a three-pointer from the halfway line for me.
I don't even know what you said there, but I think it's good. Okay, so that is Finding the Way Back, which is available on demand from Friday the 10th of July. Right, shall we move on from Affleck to Mr. Tom Hanks now? Let's all get on board with this.
Air escort to Greyhound. You will now be out of range of air cover for the next 5 days. Safe travels to England. How many crossings does this make?
This is my first.
I got some.
Most likely a U-boat.
He's trying to slip under us! Fire!
We have a kill.
Distress rockets, sir.
We have hits directly on the convoy.
The wolf pack's haunting us.
U-boat, starboard bound!
Okay, so this is Greyhound, not about a dog, We'll be coming to that. What is Greyhound, Jordan?
Yeah, so this stars and is written by Mr. Tom Hanks, his first feature screenplay since Larry Crown in 2011. It's a World War II film, and given Hanks's track record in that arena with, you know, Saving Private Ryan, Band of Brothers, The Pacific, you might rightly be expecting greatness from this. It's the story of US Naval Commander Ernest Krauss. He's in command of the Greyhound destroyer ship, which alongside a couple of other destroyers is in charge of protecting this convoy of ships carrying supplies and troops across the Atlantic from the US to Europe during World War II, and defending them primarily from German U-boats, which stalk the ocean in wolf packs. But what's quite interesting about this film to me is that almost in a similar way to 7500, which we, you know, reviewed on the pod a few weeks back, almost the entire film is set sort of in and around the bridge of the Greyhound. We get one scene right at the start where he rather formally bids farewell to his fiancée to be, played by Elizabeth Shue. But otherwise, the entirety of the film is basically a series of naval battles with this elliptical structure that cuts out everything except, you know, dropping depth charges and firing the cannons and all that kind of stuff.
It's basically Battleship. Board game in a film.
It really is, isn't it?
And as you say, it's all in the sort of bridge, apart from he occasionally pops out of the door to have a little look at the sea, or the cook comes up with a disgusting sounding sandwich to try to tempt him to eat, or a cup of coffee.
To the radar room or something.
It's very sort of intense and very sort of tech heavy, people shouting stuff, and you know, he's the captain's on con and whatever it is. I don't even know what half of the things they're talking about is. And then you also get this sort of element of the Germans sort of cracking into their airwaves and shouting horrible things down the sort of radio at them about how they're all going to die. And, you know, they love the sounds of people screaming in the water. It was so too much for me. I couldn't get on with it at all. I think I would have preferred to have played Battleships, you know, and just done that, because it didn't grip me, especially when you think about what Nolan managed with Dunkirk. Mm. This, I felt, was so muddled and required you to really be into your sort of technology and the tech speak of World War II to really get totally what was going on. Or is that just me? Had I had too many red wines at that stage? You tell me.
I largely agree with what you said. Obviously, like, as pretty much any film would do, it gains something from having Hanks in the lead role. Obviously, he always has that kind of charm and twinkle, and there's just something kind of dependable about him, like kind of on the screen and off, that you just sort of warm to him and you just kind of trust him and you just like spending sort of time with him. So he slightly elevates it for me, just having him there. And, you know, just because it's Hanks, I automatically just sort of slightly care for him and slightly hope that things go well for him. And obviously he's kind of playing arguably like against type, in a sense that he's not an experienced captain. So I think it's his first Atlantic crossing. Yeah. So again, we think of Hanks as always so dependable, you know, and like Sully, you know, he just feels like this guy who could actually land the plane. But here he's playing slightly against that. Whether or not he does it convincingly, I don't know, because I still just trusted him because he was Hanks.
You were just Hanks struck.
I was just like, Hanks struck.
It's Hanks.
But also, it's kind of 90 minutes, so it's pretty lean in that sense. I felt like I appreciated what it was trying to do, but I almost feel like maybe Hanks, the screenwriter, was trying too hard to avoid cliches. We were saying about finding the way back. You kind of get almost some stock characters in the basketball team. But here you kind of don't get any of those stock characters. You know, you don't get any sort of, oh, you know, the guy who's got a pregnant wife at home, or, you know, the, you know, seasoned old dog who's on his last mission or anything like that. You just get these completely generic faces, and Stephen Graham's kind of his second in command. And obviously Stephen Graham, great actor, but you just literally, I know nothing about his characters, just literally he's there to sort of shout numbers and use his like calipers or whatever they call to work out, you know, where these torpedoes are
prodding
coming
from. Maps and shouting.
And yeah, and as Jordan kind of pointed out as well, when he was kind of laying out the story, it's done in this weird way where it focuses on these different shifts effectively. They get these kind of 4-hour blocks of time that they kind of were focusing on at each point. And so it does just go from one bit to the next. And because, as Jordan was saying, it is so focused just on the bridge of the Greyhound and pretty much sticks with Krauss the whole time, you don't really get a sense of this convoy that they're protecting. It's this, you know, huge convoy with loads of allies on it. But you don't really get invested in that because you don't see any of them, and you don't truly get a sense of
the peril.
You don't see, yeah, the peril.
The sort of
the
peril for this whole flotilla of ships that are taking supplies, but also are loaded, obviously, with loads of people on board. You just focus on the actual Greyhound ship. So I think if you're a real sort of naval history geek or a World War II nerd, this is just a lovely thing to watch. It's just so intricate and detailed. My dad would love it, and I can imagine a lot of dads would love it.
It's a real dad film, yeah.
It really does feel like a dad film. And obviously the sort of love for Hanks goes a long way, but I think it's quite niche, really, for it to be something that a lot of people would massively enjoy.
Yeah, I think there's probably a reason this is debuting on Apple TV Plus rather than in cinemas, even with everything that's going on in the world right now. It doesn't feel out of place on streaming compared to a theatrical release. Partly because this was actually a film made surprisingly cheaply. Like, the entire budget of this film was $50 million. So key scenes were shot on a restored Fletcher-class destroyer, which is moored in Louisiana. But practically everything else has been done with visual effects. And while I wouldn't call the work bad, like, far from it,
it's one of those, tell.
Yeah, it's one of those films where you're always aware that what you're watching has been built in a computer. So you do have to get over that little hurdle. But despite having said all that, I did sort of admire the purity of the idea of what they were going for. Like, there's a bit where we spoke about earlier about the cook and various other characters who were stationed around the ship. And there's a moment in the film where, you know, a certain amount of life is lost aboard. And in any other film, you would get like a hero moment. You would get like a tragic, you know, shot of them blowing up or dying or whatever. But with this, it just happens off camera and it's really quiet and sad. And I just thought, wow, that's something I haven't really seen on film done quite that way before. And then there's a really interesting moment as well where they basically, you know, commit their bodies to the sea. They have a funeral aboard. And as they're lowering one of the bodies into the water, the body sort of gets caught on the plinth that it's on. And I just thought that was a really odd moment. And it just struck as something that was really authentic and like quite moving. Because I just thought, even though it has this streak of like, not quite jingoism, but it is very like somber and flag waving at points, it did feel like it was taking it seriously and it wasn't just showing like glorifying war or anything like that, like far from it.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess if you wanted to, you could sort of draw parallels between the sort of loss of life that's happening in this film and what's happening now with COVID-19. In as much as, you know, there aren't those big heroic moments, people are literally just dying on these boats. And when, you know, one of the supply boats gets blown up and however many people are just drowned, that's just happened. And, you know, this character is, he is a real character and he was a God-fearing man. So there's that sort of, the death of people during war is tempered with his belief system as well. I mean, when they hit a U-boat and the rest of the sort of crew are like, woo, we've killed a load of Nazis. He says, you know, that's 50 souls. I think you could watch it now in a very probably different way, as we've all been exposed to people dying a lot more than we might have been when it was initially slated for release. It probably might be more emotionally impactful now than it would have been before.
The thing I'd like to pick you guys up on as well is, it was mentioned earlier, but we get these weird moments where the Nazi U-boats kind of contact the Greyhound over radio. And to me, as someone who's not an expert on World War II naval battles, do you think there's any truth in that? Because that to me was where it did feel very cartoony, and surely this wouldn't have happened like this. Like, they wouldn't be sort of sending them such kind of...
You know, Hanks is so into World War II and his history and things. I can't imagine him putting that sort of stuff in unless there was incidents of that reported during the war. It would seem completely at odds with everything he's trying to do in this film. I see that Jordan is furiously Googling right now just to find out.
I was trying to remember who did the voice of that German, and I think it was Thomas Kretschmann, but I need to double check. But you are right, he does sound like a cartoon German villain.
I actually thought it was a bit creepy. And
you trust in Hanks?
I trust in Hanks. Who doesn't trust in Hanks? So according to the National Archives in London, there's loads of examples of interceptions of German pilots on RAF, as well as naval incidents.
Hanks got it right. Don't doubt.
Don't question the Hanks again, Matt. He wouldn't like it. He wouldn't like it. Okay, so are we recommending this one?
I personally would recommend it, with the caveat that if you're in for something that's purely action-focused as opposed to character-driven, then you'll probably get something out of this. But with the caveat that it's far from Hanks's definitive World War II movie, and it's far from the definitive kind of submarine movie. But I was pleasantly surprised by it.
Everyone should recommend it to their dad. He's going to love it. What about you, Matt?
I would scrape it the lowest 3 stars, so which would just about classify as a recommend for me, just for the kind of Hank's twinkle. But I'd do that with extreme caution. And also kind of the fact it's on Apple TV Plus, if you don't already subscribe, I wouldn't necessarily say this is going to be the film that's going to convince you to sign up to that service.
Okay, so that's Greyhound, which is available on Apple TV Plus from Friday the 10th of July. Okay, shall we go from Greyhound to A Great Dane with this?
Hey! This mangy stray's coming with me.
He's not a stray.
Okay, then. What's his name?
His name's Scooby.
Middle name?
Doobie.
Last name?
Do.
So that is Scoob! Exclamation mark. Jordan, you have a dog called Scoob. Named after this Scoob?
I do. Well, he was a rescue and he was already called Scoob, so I was never able to ask, but I can only assume he was named after Scooby-Doo. Yeah.
So he's what not is a Great happening? Dane, though. He's not a Great Dane. That would be a bit too much. What is going on with Scooby in this iteration of his dog tales?
Yeah, so this was due to be the legendary animated canine's first theatrical release movie since 2004's Scooby-Doo 2, Monsters Unleashed, but it's now heading straight to streaming. And for any sort of old school Scooby-Doo fans, rather than the you know, 2D hand-drawn animation of the original Hanna-Barbera cartoons, this is a colourful CG tune in that Pixar DreamWorks kind of mould. So it starts actually quite promisingly, I thought, by essentially telling the origin story of Scooby and Shaggy for, I think, the first time. It's certainly the first time I've ever come across it. And you get this sort of adorable meet cute on a beach. And we get a brief origin story as well for Mystery Inc. as Fred, Velma and Daphne team up with Shaggy and Scooby to solve the secret of this local haunted house. But then the film sort of jumps forward, I think it's about 10 or 15 years, and Mystery Inc. have kind of successfully foiled the plans of many a shady criminal, but their business has run into trouble, which leads to one of the most bizarre and off-putting celebrity cameos I've ever seen in an animated film, where Simon Cowell turns up and offers to invest in Mystery Inc., but only if they remove Shaggy and Scoob from the team, which, you know, that's just ripping out the heart and soul of Mystery Inc. This obviously causes something of a rift in the group, at which point the film goes in another kind of unexpected direction because Shaggy and Scoob are picked up by Blue Falcon, who's voiced by Mark Wahlberg, and Dino Mutt. They're less sort of lesser known Hanna-Barbera superhero type characters because Dick Dastardly of Wacky Races, of course.
Isn't it?
He needs Scooby-Doo, to open the gates to the underworld and unleash the ghost dog Cerberus on the world. It's a world apart from probably most of the Scooby-Doo cartoons that you've seen.
It's quite mental, isn't it?
It really just, is.
I mean, I quite enjoyed that. I was like, where are we going now? And why is Dick Dastardly in it now? Like, they've never met up before, have they?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, the film...
I've never seen that.
It quite clearly seems to be setting up some kind of, you know, Hanna-Barbera cinematic universe.
Because
you get a sort of cameo appearance from Captain Caveman as well.
Yes.
So it feels like it's building towards something bigger, or it's bringing all these characters together. But yeah, it's very bizarre. Like, I kind of admire them just going for it, but it was not what I expected.
No, I mean, I think Simon Cowell probably might put people off as a plot device. Mm. And it did feel weirdly dated, like his moment as a celebrity has sort of passed as a global person. I don't know who it would be now. Maybe it would be a Kardashian or somebody. That was the only thing that I thought sort of didn't work, because I actually really enjoyed being along for this crazy ride. And I thought, like, there was some actually really funny jokes. You know, there's jokes about Tinder. There's jokes about Hemsworth brothers. Velma's always shouting toxic masculinity. So I thought the script was actually quite witty, and I really liked who they'd cast as the characters. You know, like Zac Efron as Fred is just perfect, because he's just taking the piss out of his own sort of High School Musical persona and that sort of handsome guy who just doesn't really have a thought about anything else outside of his lovely necktie. And Gina Rodriguez as Velma, Jason Isaacs doing Dick Dastardly, completely like going for it. I loved it. And Mark Wahlberg as Blue Falcon, great. Or Falcon, as they say, obviously. This is the sort of Mark Wahlberg I want to watch. I love him in The Other Guys, and this felt like in that wheelhouse, being really silly. recall sort of Ryan Reynolds a little bit Deadpool-y, I don't know, in a weird way, sort of really taking the piss out of superheroes and their lairs and the equipment they have, all that sort of stuff. I really enjoyed it. What did you think, Matt?
I'm going to have to make a hard disagree. I thought it was verging on... I wouldn't use the word terrible, but for me it was like kind of, you know, pop the kids in front of it fodder at best, because more than anything, I suppose, I was kind of disappointed by the fact that it just didn't really feel like a Scooby-Doo film. To be fair, I haven't watched any of the Scooby-Doo stuff for years. I like the cartoons, obviously, as a kid. The whole point of Scooby-Doo is that they're solving mysteries. And I just thought this completely lacked any of that kind of mystery detecting kind of element. And to me, like, whilst obviously there's some kind of fun, you know, in seeing these Hanna-Barbera characters you recognise, I felt like it would have been better and made more sense if they had just done, like, say, like a Wacky Races film, and they'd literally sold it as this is the sort of crossover event and we're going to have characters from all the Hanna-Barbera cartoons. But instead it was like you start off thinking it's a Scooby-Doo film, and then it's like Scooby and everyone else just gets pretty much sidelined, and then it's just so dumb as it goes on, as talking about the whole underworld story, like just none of it makes any sort of logical sense.
This is like a Great Dane that can talk, right? So what sense are you looking from?
Well.
You can understand what Scooby's saying a great deal more here than you can in the original series, which was a bit off-putting.
Obviously, I'm not saying I want, like, you know, it to be entirely believable, but I just mean in terms of the logic of where the characters were just going from one moment to the next just seemed to make no sense. I you obviously appreciated it. Maybe I just wasn't in the right mood when I saw it, but I felt like all these weird adult jokes, like weird Simon Cowell cameo, Tinder references, a lot of jokes about the name Dick, just didn't feel appropriate for
children. I'm so juvenile. I laughed.
I just didn't think they were funny enough for, like, you know, for entertaining the adults who are kind of, you know, going to be dragged along to watch it. So for me, it was a kind of a big disappointment.
Miserable.
Sorry.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, don't tell Scooby.
I also thought that. As well, sorry, I actually just didn't think the animation was actually that great, considering, you know, where we're at in the world with technology and everything and what we've kind of come to expect from these sort of films, like what you expect from Pixar and Disney, etc. I actually just thought it was a bit like, you know, I can't imagine it holding up that well on the big screen. I know it's obviously ended up coming straight to small screen, but I just don't think it would have looked particularly good on the big screen.
Well, you've never sat through Paw Patrol then.
Yeah, well,
I actually didn't mind the animation. One interesting fact, I spoke to the director for this film, and he was saying that translating Scooby-Doo from 2D to 3D was just one of the hardest jobs he's ever done, because Scooby-Doo's 2D proportions are just completely wrong and just don't work in 3D when you translate it. So there's a lot of behind the scenes footage of this film where there's like a grotesquely distorted Scooby-Doo, because like his neck has to like stick out in an odd direction for it to look right in 3D, which I just found quite interesting, and I watched the whole film thinking about that. I thought this film was
could be a metaphor for saying this shouldn't have been done.
I thought this film was really sweet at points. It's a man and a dog story, but there's sort of three parallel stories going on, because you have Blue Falcon and Dino Mutt, Scoob and Shaggy, and you have Dick Dastardly and Muttley. And I thought there was actually some really sweet moments, just man and dog moments, which might just be the dog owner in me who was like projecting my own circumstances onto those situations. But
it was that.
I'm not ashamed to say that.
Dog. Excuse me, I don't own a dog, Matt. And I found Dick Dastardly and Muttley's relationship quietly moving. Thank you very much.
Me too. Surprisingly heartfelt.
Yeah, I think, to quote Dick, you're just being a mewling millennial here, and I don't think you're appreciating the joy of the Hanna-Barbera universe.
Obviously not. As Jordan said, I thought it was sweet, you know, to begin with, when you get this sort of the childhood Shaggy and Scooby meeting, which that, you know, lasts all of like 5 minutes or something. But then later they're trying to get you to care about them two in their relationship, but they've like barely been in the film. So it's like just entirely dependent on the fact that you just know they're Scooby and Shaggy, and you've probably watched them in other things before.
I mean, they are allowed to trade on that. There is a legacy, and people will associate the relationship between these characters. So I didn't have a problem with that. I did enjoy this film, but I will say that I think it really would have benefited from them not going quite so big so soon. They really went overboard, and I'm not sure it entirely needed the sort of superhero element. That sort of felt like a studio executive going, can we get some superheroes into this film?
Can we get some superheroes in, and can we also get some characters that are a bit like the Minions in as well? Just literally throw anything you can at it.
Yeah, exactly. For the most part, I did enjoy it.
Well, you know, summer holidays are coming up. A lot of people are going to be wanting something that will entertain their kids. And I think if you're looking for something that does have all those things thrown at it, then this is going to keep them quiet for 90 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, repeat viewings. This could keep them quiet for weeks/months to come.
And I might watch it again as well, because I really enjoyed it. I don't know what was wrong with me last night. I must have just been in the mood for a Scooby film. So Matt is not recommending this because he is miserable. But Jordan and I are saying, are you gonna enjoy this and get Scooby snacks out of it?
It gets four paws up from my Scoob as well.
Four paws up. Okay, so that is Scoob! Exclamation mark, because it's good fun, which is available on demand from Friday the 10th of July.
Scooby Dooby Doo!
Okay, so those are this week's releases, and it's time for this week's reader's question. What films have you guys managed to find yourselves in as extras? And if you haven't been an extra on a film, what film would you have loved to have been an extra on?
Well, it's a shame that Talk Film's Jamie Graham isn't on the podcast this week, because he is the extra/cameo king. So he's been in Shaun of the Dead as a zombie, Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, as I believe there's some guy in an airport, and The Hooligan Factory, which we need to discuss in detail.
I mean, come on, this is a starring role. He turns up for a set visit. They say, would you like to be an extra? He ends up front and center wearing a bobble hat. He gets punched physically in the face by the lead actor by mistake and broke his glasses, which I think the on-set medic was a little scared about, and probably insurance team. And then he gets a starring role in the trailer. That is really how to milk your extra 5 seconds, isn't it?
Yeah, with the immortal line, you broke my glasses.
Yeah, said in that way. Jamie, basically, we expect fully when we send him on a set visit these days that he'll turn up, if not in the trailer, then, you know, like an actual, you know, actor in the film. You've been an extra as well, Jordan.
Yeah, I have, only once, in a film that's actually yet to come out. So I have no idea if I'm actually in the finished film. So the film's called SAS Red Notice, starring Sam Heughan, based on the Andy McNab novel. It was filmed in St. Pancras, or a hotel next to St. Pancras Station in London, just over a year ago now. And for people who don't know the novel, much of it is set on the Eurostar. So the scene I was involved with was Sam Heughan's character and Hannah John Kamen, who's also in it. They were going through a sort of airport-style security in order to board the Eurostar train. So I was a fellow passenger, stood two or three people behind Sam and Hannah, just, you know, waiting to go through like the metal detector and putting all my stuff on the conveyor belt, which, so obviously I was just stood around for ages. And then every 25 minutes or so, I'd have to like take my coat off, take my bag off, take my belt off, take my watch off, put it all on the conveyor belt. But then rather frustratingly, every time, just because of the filming of the scene, they would cut just before I went through the security gate. So it was always like the slight frustration that I had to do the really annoying bit and then didn't get the thrill of going through without the metal detector going off. So,
bit like Richard Branson, who was an extra in Casino Royale.
Exactly, yeah. I recreated Branson's part.
You just wandering through there. What about you, Matt?
I've been racking my brains. I actually just don't think I ever have been an extra in anything like that.
Yeah. It happens very rarely. Yeah, like, yeah. It's happened to me once, and, you know, I've been on quite a lot of set visits. It's not a very common thing, because you're there to do a job. You're there to interview the actors or the filmmakers, and often you have to fit in between sort of bits of shooting, and they sort of can't have you on set, like, in the middle of filming and then pull you out to speak to people, and it often just doesn't work.
I mean, that's the thing that we must stress as well. When you're an extra, you are the first people probably on set. You're in hair and makeup and everything else, and you're there all day, ready to go whenever the principal actors are ready to go. So it's a long time and a lot of waiting around. And generally, from what I see of extras, it's a lot of sitting around in Victorian garb or whatever they're wearing, scrolling through Twitter or whatever it is, just just trying to fill the day because you're called just for, you know, a few moments in the middle of the day and then you're sent away again whilst they reset up the scene. So it can be a lot less exciting than it looks. And I remember we, do you remember that guy we used to work with who played a dead body on Wonder Woman? And he spent 3 days lying face down in mud. So that's glamorous.
I like to think I might be in the background of Jason Bourne somewhere because they were filming a scene from that just literally like 2 minutes out of their own from our office and wandered out to get a sandwich for lunch. And so, yeah, like I feel like maybe I was caught in the background there in one of the scenes where JB's running across the Paddington Basin, but yeah, I've never been able to freeze frame and fire myself.
And what would you like to have been in? Is that, would you have liked to have been an extra in anything?
Well, I was on the set of Alien Covenant, so I would have loved to have been an extra in that and, you know, just been murderized by a xenomorph. That would have been cool.
I'd like to be an extra in anything that just allows me to get like full prosthetic makeup on, like a kind of an orc in Lord of the Rings or something like that, you know.
Or someone in Men in Black going through the sort of the offices of Men in Black when they're going through. The thing that fascinates me is when they do music scenes where people are dancing and they just have the click track. And so they play a bit of music and then they turn the music off and you have to dance with no music because they want to obviously get the dialogue of the actors. I'd really like to go at that. I think that would be really weird and amusing. But again, probably for the first two takes, not by the 7th, 8th, 9th and 10th.
I had that on the set of No Time to Die. They were filming a sort of nightclub scene and they would be playing the music like deafeningly loud. And then as soon as, you know, Daniel Craig starts speaking, all the music completely drops out. And then there were about 20 or 30 extras in this room. They're all just kind of jigging away because non-existent music.
It's like a silent disco.
It was like really sexy dancing as well. So it was just like, it was a very bizarre situation.
Well, movie sets are bizarre situations. So on that note, we should probably finish for today. But we should also obviously always remind people that if they want to get a subscription to Total Film for them or their friends or their loved ones, there's 10% off if you go to www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk and use the code INSIDETF. So on that note, shall we say goodbye for this week?
Bye.
Goodbye.